Our next and last speaker is a man that I love to listen to, Brother Daruba Ben Wahad. He is with the Safir Bukhari and Albert Noah Washington Foundation, and he's going to talk about From Robert F. Williams to Assata Shakur, a historical analysis on U.S. political exiles living in Cuba.
First of all, thanks to the moderator and my fellow panelists and those of you who came out tonight to express solidarity and with the people of Cuba and the Cuban Revolution. I think that time won't allow me to really go into depth around the role that Cuba has played in expressing its solidarity to the Pan-African movement. I think that Cuban international policy has been the highest degree or the highest expression of revolutionary Pan-African solidarity to date. Many of the Pan-Africanists, some of whom were absent from here, have talked a lot about the history of Africa and about African revolution and all of these things, but few have put their money literally where their mouth is. We know the Cubans, the Cuban government has always supported the liberation movements of people of the third world. We know about the revolutionaries that have come from around the world to Cuba to be trained, not only as doctors, but in other areas of expertise, and who have gone on to lead their countries in the struggle for freedom and self-determination. Amilcar Cabral, who we've heard quoted here before, said that African liberation is the return of African people to the historical continuum. And that is precisely what we have to think about today. How do we, in the African diaspora, in conjunction with Africans on the continent, return Africans to their own historical continuum, especially at this particular point in time? I think it's very important for us to understand that when Robert Williams went into exile, first to Cuba and then to China in the 1960s, in the early 1960s, there was an ideological divide within the so-called international or communist movement. And that ideological divide was personified by the line, protracted People's War and People's War line of Mao Zedong and the people of China, and the mass line of the Soviet Union that believed that the working class, the industrial working class, and the communist parties of the industrial nations were at the cutting edge or the revolutionary leadership of the working class around the world in opposition to imperialism and capitalism. At that time, there were few in the African community who fully appreciated the value of Mao Zedong and the idea and the notion of people's war and protracted struggle. The Black Panther Party, of course, was one of them. The Cuban people, although they had concrete ties to the Soviet Union, were the exception to the rule within the Soviet sphere of influence. Between Castro and Yugoslavia's Tito, the support for liberation movements was uncompromising. The Soviet Union's support for liberation movements was compromising. It was conditional. It was based upon the hegemony between the East and the West, the dichotomy between the East and the West. I like to call the Cold War, and have called the Cold War, a phony war. It was a false war. The Russians and Americans never shot and killed each other directly. It was the third world's people who died and fought on the battlefields of the Cold War. The crises that we see today in the Great Lake region of Africa, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Afghanistan, all have their roots in the beginnings of the Cold War. So I just want to say that one of the principal examples of Cuban internationalism was its support for armed struggle, was its uncompromising support for freedom fighters and liberation movements. This is why the Black Panther Party found a home in Cuba. This is why our comrades who were in exile, who were fugitives, found refuge in Cuba. This is why the soldiers of the Puerto Rican Liberation Movement have found refuge in Cuba. This is why the peoples who have struggled with arms in their hands have always found the solidarity of Cuba there for them. And I think that this is a lesson that was always and has been pushed to the side and lost when we talk about Cuban solidarity, especially by today's Pan-African elders. And we must keep in mind that I have always said that unless we rethink Black nationalism and the ideology of Pan-Africanism and understand its role in the 21st century, we are whistling in the wind. The idea of self-determination based on nationalism, based on narrow nationalism, is something that we need to rethink. And I think that when we look at the evolution of empire today, how the U.S. became the preeminent empire at this particular time, and why it is suffering, as the sister pointed out, the collapse of its economic system of global control, we need to understand that we are on the cusp, we are on the brink of a new age. If African people were to take their own destiny into their own hands, if African people were to declare for themselves a United States of Africa and create for themselves their own currency and central banking system based on the wealth that is estimated to be in the ground in Africa. Because you know the U.S. dollar is not based on anything. And indeed, in this society, whenever we talk about Africans empowering themselves, we fail to realize that the empowerment of Africa is the empowerment of ourselves. I remember before Katrina, I came on a speaking tour here to New York in East Coast, and I talked about a Pan-African Refugee and Relief Agency and why it was necessary, and how the African diaspora cannot talk about a Pan-African ideology unless it begins to address the needs of people. There is no such thing as a revolutionary ideology that does not serve the needs of the people. And what are the needs of the people? The needs of the African people are very simple. They need adequate shelter. They need food. They need adequate health care. They need to be able to master their environment. They need to be able to control their own resources. They need to be able to educate their children. And we found out after Katrina that we need the same thing as well. We need adequate housing. We need to be able to control our own communities. We need to be able to have free and adequate health care. We need to be safe from attack by bandits masquerading as agents of the state. We need all of these things. So a Pan-African Refugee and Relief Agency established by the African diaspora wasn't just a dream to service Africa. It was a mechanism to acquire a constituency on the African continent. Because you see, Africans here in this room, in the diaspora, are not respected on the African continent. Our political views, our political analysis, our strategic vision is not respected amongst the rulers of Africa. Why? The major reason is that we have no constituency on the African continent. And I tell you now that the majority of internally displaced people on this planet, the majority of them are on the African continent. The majority of refugees from civil wars and conflicts are on the African continent. If you service that majority population, that population on the African continent, if we bring to them the enlightenment that we claim that we have, if we begin to meet their needs for housing, for safety, for good health care, then we've created the type of constituency that can hear what we're talking about, that can move these elitists who are running these countries. Let me give you an example. Whenever you look at a crisis in Africa, what agency do you see on the television? UNHCR, United Nations Human Rights Commission. You see Doctors Without Borders. You see Oxfam. You see all of these European non-governmental organizations who are bringing in hundreds of billions of dollars to service the misery of African people. But you don't see one black organization on the African continent unless it belongs to Seth Flo Dollar or one of these pork chop preachers who go to Africa in order to proselyte and bring the message of European Christianity to African people. They're not bringing the message of liberation theology. Not the messages of the Lucius Walkers and the Reverend Wrights. They're not bringing the liberation theology. They're bringing that theology and that ideology of the ruling elite, the elite of capitalism. And unfortunately, for those of you who drank the Kool-Aid, the present commander-in-chief that's sitting in the White House represents the hand-picked choice of that elite to head the empire. Now, we consider this an opportunity. We say, well, you know, this is an opportunity to hold his feet to the fire. But there is no fire to hold his feet to because there's no movement. The left is bankrupt in America. And the left is bankrupt in America because it abandoned meeting the needs of the people on the streets in this country. It abandoned the working class. It abandoned African people. In fact, and this is where we'll end now and start to get into more of the Cuban solidarity thing. In fact, when we look at Brother Williams in his exile in China, he became the target of the CPUSA because his popularity amongst African people and on the left was a threat to their idea and their notion of working class solidarity. You see, the Communist Party USA believed that racism was just a device of the ruling elite, and that in order to overcome it, there had to be black and white solidarity, working class solidarity. You know, Marx claims that the working class is the revolutionary engine of struggle. Well, the revolutionary he could leave off. The fact of the matter is that the United States, the white working class in America, that evolved from a system that began as chattel slavery, has always been the most reactionary working class in this country, the most narrow-minded working class in this country, the most selfish working class on the planet. And any moves that it made towards progress, it had to be pushed, kicking and screaming, by Africans demanding rights and demanding access to the same jobs and the same rights. And to this day, the unions that control many of the jobs that we seek in these urban areas are still controlled by this cabal of white supremacists who talk about qualifications and licenses and all these other facetious facades they use to keep black people out of work. So what I want to say here is that the Cubans exhibited a solidarity that did not exclude armed struggle, that did not marginalize the importance of a people taking up arms to defend their integrity and their liberty. This is why they sent soldiers to South Africa. This is why Che went to the Congo. This is why Che went throughout Latin America. This is why today we are able to say that the Cubans have supported us when even our own people wouldn't support us. Asada Shakur is in Cuba free. And we've had black elected officials sign referendums in this country to have her captured and brought back. And when they were confronted with this, one of them said, well, I didn't know Joanne Chesimard was Asada Shakur. So we need to fully understand that if Cuba can give refuge to our freedom fighters, who were members of the armed front, if Cuba can maintain that type of integrity, how is it that today, within our own movement, There's no mention of political prisoners. There's little mention of the role of the armed front in bringing us to where we are today. You know, almost every professor in every academic setting that talks about Black and Africana studies writes out the role of the Black Panther Party in the history and the recounting of the recent, quote, civil rights or Black liberation movement. And those who do put the Black Panther Party in have to offer this unique critique about an organization that only lasted a little over 4 or 5 years. Why is that so necessary? Why is an organization that was on the scene for such a brief time have such a resounding impact? There is one reason and one reason only. Because the Black Panther Party advocated self-defense of African people against the state. And that advocacy was tied to a revolutionary ideology and perception that we as African people in the United States constituted a unique people, an internal colony, a people who have been colonized by the historical events that led them to be captured and brought here to this country. And this internal colonization was unique amongst all people of the planet. But there is no recognition of our right to self-determination. There's no recognition even of our status as a internalized colony, because there's no such thing in the dialectics and the analysis and the polemics to describe an internal colony of an industrial state. So now we have reached the point where the national security state has already destroyed our movements, but they didn't destroy the longing of Black people to be empowered. There was always that race consciousness in us that existed from the very days of the bullwhip, from the bullwhip days. There was always this consciousness that when we in the room with each other, we all look across the room and say, there's a brother over there. And we work our way over to the wall. What's happening, brother? Ain't nothing. So what's going on? I don't know, man. What's going on with you? All these crackers up in here. Yeah, man, I was thinking about that too. We always had race consciousness. And that race consciousness was at its height at a certain point in the consolidation of international finance capitalism. And that was around the period preceding and directly succeeding the Vietnam War. That paradigm has not existed. Those movements were squashed. And so generations were raised without a movement, without an understanding of what happened. All they had was the gatekeepers of race politics in America to reinvent themselves every 5 years and organize a march on this, a march on that, a sit-in on that. But the fact of the matter is, the fact of the matter is that race consciousness was always there. And so when finance capital realized the inevitable, realizing that the world could not accept another white man standing up talking about how he had the solution to our problems, that with the defeat of manifest destiny and white supremacy came a need for a new face of empire. And they chose it. They chose a charismatic, very competent, articulate Black man to be the face of the empire. And we look at this as an opportunity to do certain things. Will he? Won't he? He's winking at us. But when we look at the track record, when we look at the US policies, when we look how the United States has continued to carry forward cases of rendition in the courts as we speak. They didn't dismiss the cases. He talks eloquently about closing Guantanamo. But the cases that the Bush administration brought on, he's still continuing them. The policies of the empire continue under a different face. And so it's very important to understand that what is our role here today when we talk about solidarity with Cuba? The Cuban Revolution has existed and outlived all of these reactionary presidents. So now Fidel sees his children coming to power in Venezuela, in Bolivia,
in Latin America. Latin America is moving decidedly to the left. And what will we do in response here to that? I think, brothers and sisters, we need to fully understand that what we need out of Cuba today, the type of internationalism we need out of progressive governments today, is to recognize our right to self-determination as a people.
Right.
Recognize our struggles for what it is. Don't treat us as cultural icons that you trot out at Pan-African festivals in Africa, because that's the only place that you have any consultation. Nobody listens to anything politically we're saying on the African continent. All they're doing is trying to get paid. They're trying to get as much as they can out of imperialism. They're trying to stay in power. So when we come up talking that Pan-African stuff, they said, yes, my brother. Yeah, well, we have a cultural festival for you. You see? We could sing, we can dance, we could come in and play drums, but we can't have a strategic vision for Africa.
Right.
We have to change that paradigm. There is no Pan-African Refugee and Release Agency that belongs to the African Union. We have a disposable income amongst African people in the diaspora of over $70 billion. There is no reason on this planet, with the talent that we have, with the diversity that we have, that we cannot organize an international Pan-African Refugee and Relief Agency that will move us into the continent in a fashion that will make them respect our political analysis. On Africa, if you have no back, if you have no tribe, if you have no group, if you have no constituency, you don't have jack. That's on the African continent. Meanwhile, here, what do we have? In an economy that is going down, very soon, these lights may go out and don't come back on. And if they go out in these urban areas, these urban infrastructures that we have inherited, these obsolete urban infrastructures, if these lights go out, what would you do? How would you survive? You gonna bum rush Pathmark? What will you do? These issues are very, very crucial to us, which brings me to my final point, the political prisoners. Because if we are recognized as a people that have a right to self-determination, then our political prisoners have a right to their freedom. If we have a right to self-determination as a people, that means that we have been made into a unique people through the crucible of our own history. And our own history tells us that we were taken from Africa, and therefore, if Africa is moving towards unity, it should declare dual citizenship for all Africans in the diaspora. And our political prisoners should be released to the countries in which they have their dual citizenship. That should be a principle of Pan-Africanism. That should be a principle that shows us that the Cuban people have given us an example that we can follow. We cannot abandon either our right to self-defense, either our right to sovereignty, and we sure can't abandon our political prisoners as a principle for liberation. So I just wanted to kick that to you. I know some of it went into other places. But it's very important that we understand that solidarity with Cuba today is a geopolitical decision that we will have to make as a people. That even if Obama was to remove certain travel restrictions to Cuba, that places our political prisoners in jeopardy. Because any rapprochement with Cuba means that Assata Shakur is no longer safe. Where would she go? There's no United States of Africa. Where would she go? You haven't created nothing in Africa for her to have refuge. We have no relationship with one African state that would take her. They're all punks. They're all scared. So what do? If we don't build a movement, no one will build it for us. Electing a president is a campaign. It doesn't substitute for a grassroots political movement. You can't substitute the rise of a president that was picked by Jews to be your movement. The fact that black people voted for him means that we had a race consciousness that was not tapped into by our professors of Africana studies and all of our Pan-African elders. There was a race consciousness there that we never tapped. They wound up waving red, white, and blue flags, not black, red, and green.
Ooh.
So that race consciousness was there. If there wasn't a movement, it was our fault. If there wasn't a movement, it was the fault of those who claimed to be revolutionaries and claimed to be Pan-Africans and said that the masses would never understand this and the masses would never understand that. So I just want to say, dual citizenship for our political prisoners is something that the Cubans have shown us. That they have given our political prisoners not citizenship, but they have given them refuge in the storm that has been surrounding Cuba for the past 4 decades. So I just want to say that expressing solidarity with Cuba means not only helping the Cuban people to realize their dreams and their sovereignty and breaking down the blockades and the barriers that separate Cuba from us, but it also involves upping the ante when it comes to Pan-African internationalism and taking an example of the Cubans and support those who are on the armed front. Thank you.
What Daruba was talking about was moving from race consciousness to Obama's new paradigm of post-racial America. And that is dangerous in light of the political reality. Okay, hands?
What are we not doing here? Not a lack of knowledge, not a lack of wantingness, but what are we not doing that we ought to do to get us to act in the street terms, in the layman terms, make it happen?
I think this, I mean, I can't claim to have all the answers to this, but I think that an important piece, very, very important piece, is for us to fully appreciate what the idea and the notion of global culture means. Because there's a lot of resources that we have in our community that is not conscientized. It's not focused on anything other than, you know, pimping the party principle, basically, or getting paid. I mean, we have raised a generation, or a generation has raised itself, in this society that has unprecedented liquid wealth. Unprecedented. We have young kids outside, out here, man, under 30 years old, that have incomes of hundreds of millions of dollars a year. This is unprecedented. If you look at the Zionist movement, and I hate to use this reactionary nationalism as an example to answer your question, but it's a historical example. Jews from all over the world, even though they were not Zionists, supported the idea and the notion of a Zionist state and a Zionist entity, and Jews being safe somewhere. They gave their money on the down low. They created foundations to make that happen. They created the B'nai B'rith and the Jewish Anti-Defamation Leagues and all of these different institutions to bring aid and succor to their idea and their ideology. We're not doing that. We're not doing that. Most of our professors of Pan-African studies are busy jaunting around the world giving lectures on how great we were 5,000 years ago. Or they're taking tours to Africa, you know, to Egypt, and going, and that's cool, you know, and we need to know our history, and I ain't hating on that at all. But the fact of the matter is, we need to be producing activists. We need to be producing people who understand what finance capital is going through at this moment and what we need to be preparing our people for in order to survive this. How do we survive this collapse of capitalism? Forget Obama's stimulus package for a moment. Just answering that question means we're going to fill in that gap that you asked about. What are we not doing? We're not addressing our survival as a people. We're not addressing it. We're not addressing it in concrete terms. You know, we're not taking over these urban infrastructures and rebuilding them according to our idea of survival. We've inherited these old, obsolete urban infrastructures when we migrated to these cities. White folks done left. They done moved out. And we have all of these black mayors, all of these black police chiefs, and we getting kicked off in the ass like we never did before. How is that possible?
Right.
So my answer to you is that we must address our survival on the immediate level. We have to build, like for instance, let me give you an example. For instance, Obama's victory motivated, mobilized millions of young people who never voted before. This is their first encounter with politics, quote, okay? They're not conscious movement activists, you know? They'll support Obama for hamburgers if it was packaged right, okay? But they're there. They're in the city. There's mobilized Democrats in the city. And here's an election coming up. in November, an off-year election. Do we have a citywide coalition in this in this city to abolish the police department as it now stands? Do we have a citywide coalition to take over public safety? Do we have a mechanism that we can capitalize on this energy and use it to build our own survival institutions? So we're not addressing our own survival. That's the missing ingredient.
40 years ago, black and Puerto Rican students led a strike on this campus. And as a result of that strike, there today are more black and Latino students at the City University than have ever gone to any university in the history of the United States. 10 years ago, there was a CUNY TEL program, which has basically destroyed the Black Studies Department at this college, which has basically destroyed the connections between the black students here and the community, their history. And maybe Sister Indigo might want to add something to this. What special importance and potential do you see in that CUNY students, that CUNY students of African descent have in rebuilding the CUNY movement, perhaps as a movement for reparations? In other words, tuition can be seen as free tuition as reparations and raising it to another level. Do you see any special potentials, Brother DeRoop and Sister Indigo, in the CUNY student movement at this time and place?
You know, yesterday I spoke at the High School of Graphic Arts on 49th Street, I think is whatever. And I talked to these young kids in that school. And you know, when I was going to school, I thought the graphic arts and aviation high school was schools you had to take a test to get into. You know, everybody just couldn't just go to these schools. You weren't just sent there. You had to take a test to get in. And only the people that performed at the top levels were allowed to go to those schools. I found out that the majority of kids that went to graphic arts school were sent there from all over the city. And many of them weren't even interested in graphic arts. They was just sent there. And then when they got there, they thought it was going to be this graphic arts course that was specializing in the school, and they had like one subject, and it was that was it, and it was basically crap. So I said to them, I said, you know, this is the 21st century. The teachers need you. You don't need them. You don't need this building. You don't no longer need this building. And we got on the building because people were being treated like prisoners. When I came into the place, I thought I was going to Rikers Island to visit somebody. I had to take all of my, empty my pockets out, go through a metal detector, sign in with cops at the desk. I said, how could you let somebody humiliate you every day like this? How could you be treated like a prisoner, like an animal? They're getting you ready for this all the way down the line. And this has been going on all of their lives since they were kids. Yes, right. So they expect this. So it's just a matter of time before they pull their pants down and look up their asshole because they're going to prison. The segue to prison is easy. So I said to them, you know, I hate to say this, but if I was growing up today and I was in this school and I had to go down, I wouldn't come to school. I would not let them do this to me every day. Don't you have any dignity? How could they treat you like this? You don't need them. Them teachers need you for a salary. So my point is this. The student union here at CUNY and the students at in these cities' colleges, you know, the Obama administration is releasing hundreds of millions of dollars in funds to upgrade educational infrastructures throughout the country, to provide educational facilities in urban areas and all of these things. I think one of the major features of this, of course, is conquering the digital divide that isolates the African and the poor communities in this city, in these urban areas. There is not access to the internet, there's not access to technology, learning technologies, and learning tools that can help people learn. There are people going to colleges right now getting degrees on the internet. So what I'm trying to say is that we need to rethink the idea of education in the 21st century as being rooted to a building and having to undergo instructors who have passed certain political litmus tests and who have therefore been certified to be our teachers. One of the things the Black Panther Party did, in conjunction with the strike up here, the students up here helped with the strike with the UFT back in 69, okay? When the UFT went out on strike, it was the students up here and in Columbia who came down and taught our liberation schools. So we need to reestablish that type of relationship. between ourselves, technology, and the community, and create those institutions, those educational institutions that will meet our needs. And you can forget about this building. You can forget about this faculty and these people here. We need to take this back to where it belongs, amongst our own people. We need to raise our level of technology and our level of interaction, because in today's world, information is intelligence.